Hey, everybody. Before we do anything on the show today, I think one thing that should be dealt with right up front is...
New subscriber geography trivia. You just say a person's name and then tell a fact about where they live.
Ooh, now if you're new, you've never heard this before. What is new subscriber geography trivia? Well, this is a way that I try to thank the people who sign up to make a monthly contribution to the show. I ask people for $6 a month, and you can sign up by going directly to schoolsucks.podomatic.com, and you'll see a little form in the top right corner of the page. I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. I also send out, in fact, I'm preparing some new subscriber care packages right now for people who have subscribed within the last month, bonus material, additional shows that are not available in the podcast feed. In fact, when we launch a new website, there's going to be a whole section of these shows, audio and video, and we call it the AV Club. But now I'm just emailing that stuff out. But I think it's also appropriate and necessary for me to say something on the show, because this is really what keeps our show going. Remember that School Sucks has a target audience composed of people who do not have bank accounts, who do not have credit cards, who do not have PayPal, because they are hopefully in high school. Or, geez, did I just really say hopefully in high school? Hopefully they are high school aged. Hopefully this is a message that's reaching people who are, you know, if they're stuck in high school, they are finding this, whether it's through the podcast or through Facebook or through YouTube. So it's up to us, you know, employed people with them credit cards and bank accounts and PayPals to keep this thing going. And, you know, our subscription model is in lieu of advertising, because I think this is a much more enjoyable show when it doesn't have to stop every 15 minutes so you can hear some guy say, "Hey, do you want to get some Liberty stickers to put on your backpack so everybody knows that you want to end the Fed?" I don't want to do that, right? Our live show works like that because we're on LRN. So for the video version of that show, we've actually had to come up with activities that we can do to entertain the audience during the break. And if you've only ever heard our podcast, I suggest you check out our live show Thursday night at 10 p.m. It's a different experience than the podcast, for sure. But yeah, I don't want to do advertising. I want this to be a listener-supported project, and hopefully when the new website arrives, that model will become much more realistic. But it's never too early to start, and I really need your help. I really want to double the number of subscribers that we have, and I know we can do it. This is New Subscriber Geography Trivia. I just want to say thank you to all of these people who subscribed since August. And because it is so many, we're going to have to do this probably in three sessions. So if you don't hear your name and your exciting town and facts about it today, stay tuned, because you will hear it within the next couple of shows. Okay, so first we have Jeff. And Jeff is in Fairfax, Virginia. That is the location of the annual Chocolate Lovers Festival. And the Chocolate Lovers Festival is not just about little goodies that you can put in your mouth. You can also go there and check out the chocolate sculptures. Ask Christina Hendricks about it. She went to high school in Fairfax. And next we have, I want to say Yahaira. It's J-A-H-A-I-R-A. She is in Kearney, New Jersey. Now, you Sopranos fans, Kearney, New Jersey, that's where that Satrialis pork store, that butcher shop that they all hung out in front of, that was in Kearney. How about that? Next, we have Brent, who is from Linwood, Washington. That's the home of Lane Stanley, the former frontman from Alice in Chains, and later Mad Season, a collaboration between Lane Stanley and that guy Mike from Pearl Jam. In fact, their song River of Deceit is one that I've used on the show several times in the past. Alice in Chains was part of that whole Seattle grunge scene in the 90s, and Linwood, not too far away from Seattle. I don't know that from a fact, but I definitely know that it is in the same state. Then we have Virginia. She is in Houston, Texas. Houston, Texas, the home of what is often referred to as the eighth wonder of the world, the Houston Astrodome. and Astrodome, big improvement over the original name. And in 1965, it was called the Harris County Dome Stadium. It was one of the, no, it was the first indoor stadium for baseball. But did you know that on June 15th, 1976, there was actually a rainout at the Astrodome? Not because the dome collapsed or the field flooded, but there was flooding outside in the Houston area, and people couldn't get to the game because there was just too much rain. So you know what the players did? They put some tables out on the field, and they had dinner together. Next, we have Christy, who's in Edmonton, Alberta. Did you know that Edmonton, Alberta is home of the largest planetarium dome in all of Canada? And Canada is a big country. It is at the Odyssey Space and Science Center. Moving right along to Raul, he is in Richmond, California. Did you know that Richmond, California has been determined to be the third most dangerous city in the United States? And it's not because of the fault lines and sinkholes that occasionally pop up there. This has to do more with the carjackings and murder. So if you're ever in Richmond, California, be extra careful. Neil, who wanted to be identified as Honest Gold and Silver Buyers LLC, that's in Atlanta, Georgia. So I said to my new subscriber geography trivia team of investigators, let's get a fact about Atlanta that has something to do with gold. And here's what we came up with. The State Capitol building is layered with 43 ounces of pure gold mined from nearby Delenga, Georgia. Next, we have Mickey, who's in Mount Laurel, New Jersey. Did you know that in New Jersey, it is a law? Boy, if I had a nickel for every time somebody said that. But did you know that there is a law in Mount Laurel, New Jersey that you cannot get drunk and annoy people in your own home? It's on the books. Now, you might be saying, get out of town, Brett. To which I would reply, yeah. Especially if I'm in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, and I want to get drunk and annoy people in my own home. Get out of town. Actually, in New Jersey, I think it's township. Get out of township. So that's going to be it for today. I've got a whole nother group for next time. So if you didn't hear yourself today and your town and a fact about that town, because that's how this works, stay tuned. It's coming within the next couple of shows. So that's, what do we call this?
New subscriber geography trivia. You just say a person's name and tell a fact about where they live.
And if you don't mind, I'd just like to slip one more in because it was an email from this next person who inspired me to do new subscriber geography trivia today, to get organized and get back into thanking the people who subscribe to this show. His name is Pat. But when I started researching where he lived, I couldn't find anything interesting. It was Pickering, Ontario. And I wrote to him and asked, and he said, no, nothing interesting about Pickering, Ontario. But then me and my team probed a little deeper, and we found this from the National Post, which is a newspaper in Canada. This is January 6, 2012. Pickering Dungeon House with Mysterious Confinement Room burns to the ground in suspicious fire. Turns out there was this old, creepy, abandoned farmhouse in Pickering that burned down mysteriously, which is strange because at the time, police were conducting an investigation into a dungeon that they found in the basement. So at some point, something interesting was happening in Pickering. Okay, so the show today is my appearance. This was actually last Wednesday, right after Election Day. I was on Sex, Lies, and Anarchy podcast, and the show has a title, which suggests that it has one specific topic, but we really went all over the place and covered a lot of stuff. The show runs long, about an hour and a half, and I really enjoyed this discussion. So I've edited this a little bit. If you want the full version, it's available at sexliesanarchy.com, and I highly recommend their podcast. They cover a variety of different topics, and you know, if you've gotten bored with whatever you listen to, Free Talk Live, you know, go check them out. So that's it. I'm going to let this run. This show has strong language in it, and I mean like all the strongest language, like the F word, is in this show. So You have been warned. And that's it. So more shows coming soon. We did a fun one last night that I can't wait to get into editing. And that should be out in a couple of days. Thanks for listening and take care.
You found sex,
lies,
and anarchy.
If you wanna fly.
Broadcasting to you from our authentic 19th century farmhouse in the Liberty Haven of New Hampshire.
Liberty is about to get personal.
Welcome to Sex,
Lies,
and Anarchy.
We are your hosts, Antigone
and Celestina.
And that lies you just heard is Brett from the School Sucks Project, a good friend of ours that we've known for a while. He's got his own podcasting experience.
I do. Over 3 years now.
Quite a bit, yes.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about School Sucks?
Well, schoolsucksproject.com is the website. And I started doing the podcast back in 2009, and it was a show where I guess our mission statement would be to take that word education back from the state, to take it back from the indoctrinators who are doing schooling, and you know, redefine it for what it actually means, which is a lifelong, self-directed process driven by people's own motivations and not trying to please or satisfy some kind of authority figure. And it has nothing to do with grades and filling out forms. It has to do with, you know, following one's own desires.
Right. And I think a lot of libertarians like to blame public school for a lot of things, but I like that you deal with the whole this system. I went to private school, and yes, thank you, parents, for sending me to private school. It was a little bit better. However, it's still that same factory system of how they just run kids through that machine.
It's a lot of, you know, public school plus God.
I went to Catholic school in California. There was church, but it was when I dealt with public school kids, they didn't know what a 5-paragraph essay was. And I was writing them when I was 8 and, you know, making points and things like that. So academically, it was more difficult, and not just in the regurgitory type of way, but we were forced to make arguments. So I don't know if it was because of how liberal California was that I didn't get too much of the religion thing.
Right. Mm-hmm. I just mean it, they're regulated in the same way in most states.
And I would say that most of my important realizations about the schooling system in the country in general, I came to while I was working in private schools that had nothing to do with religion. So, yeah, I think that state, that factory system is very pervasive. And it's just a model that's been copied because, you know, aside from what it does to children, if you're the people in charge, it's pretty efficient. Get them all lined up.
There's a TED Talk that I saw that I posted on my brother's wall on Facebook when he sent my poor little nephew to school for the first day. And he had all the stereotypical photos where, like, my nephew's crying. He doesn't want to be taken from his parents, that whole thing. And it was just so sad for me to watch. So I posted the TED Talk about the Prussian school system. And he and my dad all chimed in, like, oh, yeah, that's right. We should reform it. You know, that whole mentality. And I want to link to that. And I also want to link to a video that you did, Brett, that I rewatched today. School the American Way.
Yeah.
It was very well done. I enjoyed that a lot, actually. I think people need to watch that for sure.
I think it's got way more hits than there are libertarians in the world. So I would call that a success.
When I saw it earlier today, it was 102,000.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, pretty confronting stuff to realize that we are, where does it come from? I wish I could get that out of my vocabulary.
Yeah.
But I do think it's a very difficult realization for people to have that, you know, this society that they're comfortable with, whether you want to say that you're a part of it or not, is really following as the Leonard Peikoff called it, some pretty ominous parallels with what was going on in Germany in the 1930s. And, you know, it should be no surprise that people know the history. We have the same school system, and we have pretty much the same philosophy that made most of what happened there possible, where people wind up trusting authority because they don't believe really in the competency of their own minds, because reality is unknowable and your mind is not trustworthy and you have to defer to authority. And maybe no one ever says that to themselves, like, oh, you know, I'm dumb. But it's certainly when you look at like what we just went through, where people are expecting some politician to save them, it's certainly pretty widespread.
This reminds me of the last couple of weeks of my life where I've been organizing people that got this job via Craigslist. And I had 16-year-old kids. And I'm not going to call 16-year-old kids stupid, because I certainly wasn't, and you guys probably weren't. But these kids, I don't know where they came from. We had a bunch of issues that we had to deal with. I was organizing a bus of people. People came up to me and asked me really silly questions, like, I left my phone at the last location. Can we go back and get it? Well, of course we're going to go back and get it. Like, yeah, sure. But also, at one point, I had a walkbook to hand out to these people, and the kids, not the adults, but the kids, all started raising their hands. And I said to them, do you need to go potty? Like, why are these kids raising their hands?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
The concept of having to raise your hand to go to the bathroom is ridiculous. And I remember, as a female, too, in an all-chick high school, if you need to go to your little designated spot where you have your stuff to go get a feminine hygiene product or whatever, it becomes an issue because you need to raise your hand and announce it. And then the entire room looks at you as you go get your thing.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
But what wouldn't look like freedom after that? You know, 15,000 hours of asking permission to talk and pee. Certainly, you know, the adult world would seem comparatively free.
Well, no, because then that's when the TSA comes in and it's like, well, yeah, I had to like grab a tampon in public, basically, right? Because I had to announce it and go do that. So if they need to fondle me to make sure that there's no terrorist attacks, that totally makes sense. That's just the next step down the line.
Oh, sure. And I really think that, you know, some of the stuff that we see in the schools is really a harbinger for what people can expect in adult society. And if you look at the crackdowns that have taken place in schools, I mean, I hate to call something like this famous, but Goose Creek Elementary School, this drug raid, this was back in 2004. Where armed men came into a school with dogs barking at kids because the school had a marijuana problem, right? So this is how they responded to it.
Not that it matters, but was this elementary, junior high, high school?
This was a high school.
Okay.
And, you know, terrorized these kids and found no drugs. But this became a more frequent occurrence ever since Columbine, right? So, you know, you are the problem. It matches the template that pretty much society is based on, that people are born evil and then they're made good by authority. So,
yeah, there was a more recent notable example of that where some young girl got strip searched because she had ibuprofen, right?
Yeah, I think that was within the last couple of years.
Yeah.
And I actually did a show called Police State Pupils, which was about 45 minutes of these types of examples that we're talking about. Goose Creek Elementary, that story, Celestina was actually in that show. And then, you know, listening to adults be interviewed about the TSA saying, I'm happy to be patted down. You know, I don't want to be on a plane that blows up. So whatever violation of, you know, my person or privacy is necessary. But I mean, that's conditioning.
I mean, obviously, Brett, you've spent the last 3 years talking about school because that is so important, how you condition people to respond in such a way. So, but it's also bigger than that.
Yeah, I think it encompasses all of childhood, which brings us to our topic today, which I've been wanting to talk about for a long time. Actually, if you've been listening to the show for a while, you've probably heard me say that childhood is like Stockholm Syndrome. So we've touched on this topic a number of times, and I think it's great that we can finally have a real discussion about it. And having Brett here, I think, is the perfect guest to do it with. So what we are going to talk about today is how the government prevents children and young adults from attaining autonomy through various means like child labor laws, age restrictions, the regulation of apprenticeship programs, the difficulty of being emancipated before the age of majority, the system that's in place now to deal with children who are in bad situations, just likes to put kids in foster homes, make them wards of the state, drug them, whatever. The solutions of the system tend to lead to more abuse. But without all the laws that hold young people back, there would be ways that young people could escape bad situations by themselves.
Sure. Yeah, I think we're often kind of accused by people who are outsiders or norms or political folks of being these one-trick ponies of, well, you know, what your thing is that it's the government, but what is your solution? Well, are we even really having a conversation, or do you only define solutions as the government doing something through the use of force, through the use of coercion, to make a change based on what exists now? And yes, if that is your definition of a solution and that's a box that you're stuck in, then yeah, maybe it seems like the things that we're talking about are not solutions. And I think there are a variety of ways to explore this topic. If you want the bigger picture, it's a story that could start either in, you know, ancient China or the Industrial Revolution, because this is nothing new. And it's something that has been accelerating, you know, through recent times, definitely. And I think there's also more of an Occam's razor approach that, like, does the government exist? Yes. If the government exists, it's growing. And if the government is growing, people in general are getting less freedom, less autonomy, less privacy. And children, and even adolescents, which is a made-up term, we'll talk about that, are voiceless in that process. So they don't even have the opportunity for pushback. You know, there is no children is not a special interest group. Children are the victims of most of what goes on, because they have no real advocates beyond the empty platitudes of politicians when they say it's for the children, but it's usually almost always at the expense of children. So, I mean, the simplest explanation is, you know, if the government's here, the government grows, and that affects everybody in the long term negatively. And, you know, children are always going to get the brunt of that because they don't have any voice in that process.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting today while I was doing some research. I found some information that was kind of like news to me. And I feel like this is something I should know, but it still kind of blew my mind that child abuse is legal everywhere in the United States. You know, I thought it was just maybe a couple backward states. I'm not going to say which ones. I got made fun of earlier for talking about this. So I thought maybe it was a couple of backward states that still allowed you to beat your children, but it's every single one. It's actually federally legal, and each state has different statutes about how you can beat your children, but they're all extremely vague. Like, they say things like excessive, but they don't define excessive. I can't believe that this is not an issue. Like, children's rights is not more of an issue. All the things that, you know, people campaign for, all the single issue voters, all the big issues, children's rights are just not even, like, you never even hear about them. And, you know, it's because, you know,
they're not a voting bloc.
They're not a voting bloc. And that also tells me that most parents want to keep the right to abuse their children.
I think there's something deeper, too, that, I mean, it relates to what you're saying, but if people look at how children are treated today, there is the risk that they might wind up looking at how they were treated as children. And there's all kinds of negative implications for a lot of people emotionally to do that. So, I mean, if we look at how problems are dealt with generally politically in the adult world to the child world or to the adolescent world, it's the rule is usually anything that does not involve self-examination, right? I mean, so it's always what's wrong with these kids today. And the result of that is always some kind of crackdown.
Yeah, and I mean, if you actually made abuse illegal,
talk to kids? Oh, my God.
People would have to look at their own childhoods and see that something was wrong with it.
Yeah, exactly. But there's all this momentum against it, too. So, like, let's look at who the players are in that. We have the media, the mainstream media, who for the last 20 years has really since the advent of cable news, I would say, is in the business of, you know, scaring people, thriving on chaos and panic. And anytime there's something like a potential crisis, what? Go ahead.
Just way more than 20 years.
Well, but I would say really the real acceleration of this, when it really went crazy, because, I mean, people could identify yellow journalism 100 years ago and say, oh, you're a jingoist, you know, like,
right,
who's going to take you seriously? But the jingoists today are considered the news, pretty much. Fox, MSNBC. So, I mean, and the media is incredibly subservient to the power structure, to the state, because...
Well, you know where most people get their news from. Like, most people between the ages of 18 and 35 get their news from The Daily Show.
Sure.
So, CNN, Fox News, MSNBC, they're on their way out.
Well, I certainly hope so. But a
lot
of,
I'm being idealistic.
Well, I think a lot of the decision makers or the people who are lending legitimacy to the system are still obviously watching, you know, Fox and MSNBC. And there's another one. What's the other one? CNN. And the media thrive on panic. And one of the most popular words for politicians and the media that serves their interests is crisis. Right. So all of these things, teenage drug use, teenage pregnancy, teenage violence. Right?
Teenage obesity.
Sure. Absolutely. Can all be, what are we going to do about this crisis? Now, let's have a balanced discussion about it where we get input from both sides. So here,
all two of them.
Well, that's the important thing. So here comes the left, and they say, well, you know, it's about poverty and it's about racism. And first and foremost, it's about not having enough funding pouring into these schools. And now let's hear from the right. Oh, it's Marilyn Manson and television violence and the accessibility of pornography. But in that balanced discussion, you have, I would think a balanced discussion would be like including input from adolescents, but they're silent. There is no input. So it's adults who don't want to look at the root causes of an issue, basically, you know, having what is essentially a one-sided conversation because the most important participants were not invited.
Right. So you have all these people on both sides saying, oh, it's for the children. But obviously it's not for the children because we have state mandated violence against children.
Sure. I think it was something like over 200,000. In a recent year, the last study I saw, over 200,000 occurrences of corporal punishment in schools.
Yeah.
Now that's in public.
And those are reported.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I don't think anybody wants to admit that they were abused. So these are the cases where maybe somebody admitted it.
Sure.
Fine. But anytime that would happen in a school, you're going to have it be witnessed by what? Public schools have like 30, 40 kids per class. You have plenty of witnesses.
I mean, does it always go on in front of the class? I think it might go on in private.
They have designated spankers, usually only administrators. In fact, I think they were just talking about a story on Free Talk Live. At the beginning of October, there was a story on Free Talk Live about how some school in the South had lifted their very strict regulations that limited spanking to administrators, where now any school employee could administer the spank.
Who the hell is sending their kids to public schools?
It's not always even just not that this is okay, but it's not even just a spank. Like, they use implements too in school.
Paddles. Yep.
It's weird. There was this line in Girl Interrupted that really affected me where someone says to the parents of Winona Ryder's character, if half of that abuse was true, would you still try to get her out of here? And I think it's the dad says yes. And then he tries to get her out of that institution. If only half of, even if she is a little off, right?
Right.
If half of that is true, you would still try to get her out of there. This is all new to me because I went to private school, so it's a little bit different. And I was hit by my piano teacher after school. She had this really long pen that would like come out as a pointer, but she would hit our knuckles with it. But in school, I was never afraid of a teacher hitting me. That is completely like outside of my reality. I remember hearing stories of like grandparents and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, I remember my sister talking about it. She went to the same high school as me 15 years earlier, and I don't know if she ever got hit, but I know at that time it was still legal to hit a child in school. And I mean, I grew up in New Jersey, and it's actually one of the states that in both public and private schools it's illegal to hit a child, but only 15 years earlier they were doing it.
There are so many reasons I'm not going to breed. And I think back to a time I was a teenager and there was this chick yelling at her kid in the middle of a crosswalk, like at the mall. So it's not like a real crosswalk.
Sure.
And she's yelling at the kid. The kid like sat down for some reason. And she said, I'll give you something to cry about. And she's threatening the kid. And she's obviously a miserable person that has no business being a mother whatsoever. So I don't know what the libertarian response to that should be, because before I've advocated just taking the kid, right? But then I'm just another CFS. But these people can also be really concerned about CFS, right? Where I have heard stories that one of their friends is sterile or what have you and wants a, let's take an obvious example, some like blonde, blue-eyed little girl that's really cute.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard stories of families that have been targeted and that little girl gets taken because the sterile couple wants that girl.
Oh, yeah. I'm absolutely not saying that is the answer. You know, all these child abuse laws that I was reading today, it just, you know, made me think somebody will call it child abuse and take a child away from a family if they find a joint in your house. But not if you beat your kid. That's perfectly legal.
Well, I would say that this was a pretty common occurrence. And I think that those things with CPS, there are those stories, but they tend to be more anecdotal. More generally speaking, a bureaucracy's purpose is to justify its existence. Right. So CPS has to, and you also have this illusion of a moral high ground. You know, I work for the government in child services. So this facade of legitimacy exists in front of whatever they do. You know, obviously, I mean, I have a windbreaker on that says CPS. So, you know, I clearly have the moral high ground here. But I worked in a residential school from 2000 to 2004. And what was not the rule, but was relatively common, was kids were taken out of homes, as you said, where drug use occurred. Now, drug use quite frequently is marijuana. And they were put into foster care where they were abused, not just physically, but sexually. Right, which is very, very common. So when we go from the child and adolescent world to the adult world, we have something like the TSA, which we've already talked about, which is very attractive to people who like to, you know, usually just maybe had to settle for rubbing up against somebody in an elevator or peering at somebody with a pair of binoculars, but now can actually get really hands-on, pretty much with impunity. So what kind of people might be attracted to foster care? What kind of people might be attracted to residential care if they know that, again, with impunity, they can be abusive? I mean, these things happen. And I worked with people who, I mean, there wasn't, at the time I was very young and they had a lot of seniority, but I saw a lot of things being done to kids as far as the treatment in this school where I said, geez, you know, this isn't right. And I was very compliant, very polite. Public school and college graduate, respecting seniority, but not really feeling good about what I was seeing, because those kinds of people are attracted to that bench in that black robe. They're attracted to that blue uniform. They're attracted to that green uniform. They're attracted to positions of authority that they don't have to earn through some kind of behavior.
And what kind of people are accepting of this authority? Pretty much, unfortunately, pretty much anybody who's ever been a child.
Yeah.
You know, anybody who has learned to sympathize with their captors, and that's what we have in society today.
Mm.
I mean, I'm talking about some really terrible cases, but I think no matter what, childhood kind of sucks. You know, you're a prisoner, and you might be a prisoner in a gilded cage, and you might have people who treat you with as much respect as possible. But you're still a prisoner, and it's pretty awful, and it's pretty, like, just being a child, I think, can be potentially psychologically damaging. And I mean, I think the best that people can do as parents is give your child as much respect and freedom and autonomy as they can manage, but, you know, then they might just get taken away from you.
And be in touch and in tune with their ability and their willingness, which is probably going to change very quickly, to manage more freedom and autonomy.
Yeah.
But I mean, yeah, you're right. I mean, they're trapped. And, you know, for me, like I talk to so many people here in New Hampshire and libertarians in general who specifically like my co-host Osborne. And so many people say, yeah, I always knew I was smart. I always knew I was always an atheist. I always knew that these things were BS. And I was always like, please, adults, with your God and your voting and your Easter bunny, you know, but for me, it was always like this quiet resignation. Like until I was probably in college, if somebody had said your behavior needs to be modified or, you know, you need to be drugged, I probably would have said, well, you know, I wouldn't have said, oh, thank you, authorities, for taking me, you know, under your care. But there would have been this quiet resignation of, well, you know, I guess other people know best and that's the way it is. And maybe I would have been upset about it, but it would have been quiet. And I think from what you're describing about childhood, Celestina, it can go one of two ways. It's rebellion, which, as I said to so many kids that I worked with, has consequences, especially when you have so little control over so many aspects of your life at that age. Or, you know, even worse, conformity, where you accept it.
Even worse.
Yeah, and basically this pattern is established, unfortunately, for a lot of people, lasts their entire lives.
Yeah, so these are your choices.
But they actually have a designation now for rebellion. It's ODD.
Yeah.
It's in the book. It's in the book now. What is it?
DSM.
Oppositional Defiant Disorder.
Yes.
Yeah, this website I was talking about as I was playing the internet game and I got curious about what the different child abuse laws are in different states. I finally found a website that detailed what they are in different states. And then I, you know, backtracked to the homepage and I realized that this webpage was legal advice for parents.
On how far you can go?
On like a whole bunch of different things. But yeah, that's what that particular page was about. But there were articles on things like ODD. What do you do if your child is ODD? And
you beat them.
Probably.
An ODD is not.
But only according to state statutes. So you don't get, your kid doesn't get taken away from you and you don't get thrown in jail.
Just make sure it's not excessive.
Yeah. Whatever that means.
The origins of ODD, I'm not sure of as far as that specific disorder. But you know, one early episode of my show, it was called Drapetomania. And I don't know if you've ever heard of Drapetomania. Mm-hmm. There was a doctor who was an apologist for slavery in the 1850s. And at this point, even before, you know, Lincoln came along with his hat and his beard and his tyranny, slavery was on the way out. You know, he was jumping in front of a parade ideologically. And, you know, in an effort to save this institution, one of the things that apologists tried to do was to establish that slaves who wanted to free captivity were actually stricken by a psychological defect that the doctor called drapetomania, which was an irrational compulsion to flee his master's captivity. They had one for ADHD, too. It was called dysthesia aethiopis. I'm mispronouncing that, I'm sure. But it was, you know, being unattentive to the needs of the master, which is essentially ADHD, and drapetomania is ODD. So when you have a system that is philosophically and morally corrupt, boy, you don't want to do like an in-depth evaluation of that system that you benefit from so much and that you're so comfortable with. You want to blame whoever the victim of that system is. And that's certainly become the trend with adolescence, with public schooling over the last century, for sure.
I mean, there is just absolutely a huge trend of ageism right now towards children. It's always teens are such a problem.
Well, we have the media, right, which we talked about as far as being, you know, the parrots on the shoulders of the pirates of the state, you know, that are just going to, you know, it's a tricky business. You need access, and to get access to the people that you're covering, you need to be very polite, and that means not asking them, you know, hardball questions. So the media is very compliant. The media is very subservient. They also benefit from the appearance of crisis. Using kids as crises in all the ways we described is easy because kids can't be reasoned with, you know, and they have no voice in that conversation, so you don't even get to hear their side of the story when it comes to sex or drugs or violence. And the politicians, the bureaucracies, the schools, they all benefit from those perceptions of crises. You know, they can exploit them to justify their existence, like we talked about before. So, and then who else benefits? Well, you have institutions, pharmaceutical companies. Between 1980 and I think the year 2000, the institutionalized population of adolescents increased by almost 400%.
And how about the ones that weren't institutionalized but were just put on Ritalin or what have you?
Sure.
Drug-free school zone signs are hilarious because they're putting these kids on all these drugs. And these parents are so confused as to what to do because they're dealing with, sure, maybe it's a made-up term, adolescence, but they are adults in every way of the word, but they are treated as children and hence I mean, all the confusion and everything that happens with adolescence, what are they supposed to do? And then you don't know how to talk to your teenage kid. But you were a teenager. Like, it shouldn't be that this difficult. But then again, like I say this about genders all the time, where men and women keep on getting this gap between each other because of how society treats them. It's the same way with adolescence, where like they're not children, they're not adults, they're not allowed to really be anything.
Yeah.
They're just a like confusion ball. And it's okay to say, I don't get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, and naive parents will hear from someone in a position of authority that their children need to be on drugs. And they're those same people who were raised under authority. And, you know, they just think, I don't know any better than this person in authority. So I'm going to drug my child.
Well, I think there's a pile on there, right? Because obviously they've been trained in conformity. And I think there's a general unwillingness to self-examination, you know? And the outgrowth of that politically, societally, culturally is pretty significant. I could certainly do more myself, and that's the only person that I can speak for. But I think even, you know, a lot of people who have similar philosophies to us, like a lot of people, when they learn this idea, the first thing that they do is they go as far away from themselves as possible. They say, oh, I'm going to get Ron Paul elected president and then we'll end the Fed. You know, I mean, you couldn't get any further away from personal freedom with that path. So, yeah, I think that obviously their training in conformity and compliance is a big part of it for them to be parents. But then also that sort of mantra of I turned out fine. Right. Because what if I didn't turn out fine? You know, that's not a road that most people want to go down.
And another thing is like, what you have going on is nothing compared to what I had going on when I was a kid.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
You know, my parents beat me with the back end of a machete. So.
Yeah. And I could even detect that, like with my own father, for example, right? Like he wanted to be better than his parents. So he would, you know, consciously make these efforts to say, I didn't have this, or I didn't get this, or no one ever did this for me, you know, when I was a kid. So I'm going to do it for my kids. But through the lack of, you know, confronting his own issues from childhood, wound up passing a lot of that stuff as an inheritance. And this is something that Nathaniel Brandon talks about in a book that we covered on my show recently called Breaking Free, where if these things go unexamined, they just pass from generation to generation. And if you look at how children were treated 100 years ago, 200 years ago, and what we are ultimately trying to achieve with a free world or you know, voluntary society, the momentum against that is just, you know, generation after generation of this being passed, and even suggesting that there could be another way is very controversial for a lot of people because it involves going back. I mean, you think about how hard it is to change somebody's mind politically, right? Where there's far less at stake emotionally than, you know, having a conversation with a parent about how they're treating their child.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe in some situations, I mean, for example, like my dad, I'm sure he didn't have like a great childhood or anything, but he had way more freedom than most children have now. And we talked about this on the School Sucks Live show. When my dad was 10, he chose his own apprenticeship. He moved to Rome and studied shoemaking. And when he didn't like his shoemaking master, he thought he was kind of a hack. He found a better master. He looked all over Rome until he could find the best shoemaker in Italy. And these are the decisions he made for himself when he was 10 years old.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I think it goes both ways, where parents are generally and hopefully, maybe this is a little presumptuous, but becoming more enlightened, because even though they might have some of that transference of their own trauma or experience, they do make this conscious effort to do better than their parents. But pulling against that in the other direction is the state, right? Which makes all of those things that your father did completely impossible for somebody in this country today. And I'm sure in Italy, where he was.
Psychology of parents is a complex thing. Like, oh, yeah. Say for example, you know, when you were a child, you were neglected, you know, and you don't want to neglect your children. Some people just go in the total opposite direction and are completely controlling.
Yeah.
As long as I'm fed, I'd rather be neglected. I'm okay with that. I had books.
Yeah, we were talking about that. I had Mark and Ian on from Free Talk Live to talk about punishments and rewards. and getting sent to the room. And Ian was saying, I was happy. I wanted privacy. And mm-hmm. I think that's something that, you know, I feel bad for kids because they have so little of it, you know? So I think neglect, especially at a younger age, leaves a very negative imprint. But by the time you're like 11 or 12,
you're
it's like
neglect the hell out of me.
Yeah, leave me. Please. Just as long as there's a hot dinner, lock me in my room. But that's a symptom of a problem as well. When kids don't want to be around their parents, I think.
Sure, I hear so many people say, "Oh, you can't be your kid's friend, right? You have to be an authority figure. You can't be your kid's friend."
What's your goal? You know, like if you have to be the authority figure all the time, what is your goal? I know that I'm the child of a single child, and so she felt obligated to have children. Her goal was to have me have children for her parents. Something crazy like that, which didn't work. So, I don't know. I was supposed to look a certain way. She stole clothes from me. She didn't like my whole t-shirt, whole Courtney Love's band.
Yeah.
She stole that.
You're a little punk rocker, Antigone.
That is not punk. That is grunge.
Oh,
excuse
sorry.
Excuse you.
No. So you were like lamer than I thought.
I was uber lame. Yeah. I went to private school. I was a libertarian in private school. It sucked.
I guess you were kind of cool.
I started a libertarian group in my high school. Nerd. Yeah.
That's kind of cool.
There were all two of us.
In your libertarian club?
Yes. Well, I had one civics teacher. I think she just liked the fact that I had a statement to say about anything, pretty much, and she sponsored my group. And we talked about economics and this type of thing. It didn't really go very far. But, and I also ran a campaign to legalize all drugs, and I got 48% of the vote. All drugs, not just marijuana. I thought marijuana was too easy.
What, in your school?
Yeah.
Was it like a mock?
Yeah, it was like a mock election. So I would have had to pick a candidate had I been in one of the other years, but it was a candidate proposition. I ended up with a proposition. I chose this one. I did the debates. Well, what if you're on PCP and you jump out a window? Yeah, what if you jump out a window? I don't understand what PCP has to do with anything. And the fact that I got 48% of these very elitist women, girls, teenagers to vote against the drug war entirely. I took that as a win that I got 48% from my proposition. Because I'm not just talking about marijuana. I'm talking about heroin. I'm talking about PCP. I'm talking about you can ingest whatever you want. It's still illegal to kill people. I took that as a win for sure.
Your little two-person libertarian club reminds me of one of our friends who has a couple of kids that are totally awesome. One of his daughters, he got called into school. I think you guys may have heard the story before. But he got called into school, and the teacher said that she was worried because his daughter had started an anarchist club.
She's what were
like,
they doing?
She's like 12. And that's what our friend said. What were they doing? And she said that they were reading books and talking about them. He was like, isn't that what you do here?
So at this point, to do here. It's just a thought violation. You get thought detention for...
Yeah, they had a book club.
Unfortunately, I believe you. So getting arrested for book clubs.
No, she's not getting arrested. Her dad just got called into the principal's office.
For?
Her being an anarchist and having a club where they read books and talked about them.
Really exploring anarchy. I mean, what does it mean to be an anarchist when you're like 11 or 12 or 13?
I think most of us are anarchists when we're that age, and then we get involved in the way people tell us the world is supposed to work.
Well, I know, but the ist at the end of something also implies that in addition to the thought, there's some kind of exercise, you know? Like, you're not much of an atheist when you're 8, but you're sitting in the pews of a church, right? Like, maybe you are.
Just because you don't believe in God? You an atheist? Is that what you're trying to say?
For all intents and purposes, yeah, you're still stuck in a church, right? So,
well, I was put there by my Catholic school, so I'm not going to count that. Although okay. I did get called into the office because I refused to stand when the priest did this.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
No, they let me sit. They let me sit all through school. I mean, I went to private school, and I went to private parochial school because my only other choice the public school in the town that I moved into was apparently so crap that the president of the Board of Education sent his kids to private school. And actually, it's kind of a funny story. My mother used to threaten me with going to Catholic school every time I complained about school. And I'd be like, oh, school sucks because of this. And she would be like, well, you could always go to Catholic school. And then one day I was so fed up with the school I was in. I had just moved to a new town and I was there for 3 months and it was so horrible. And she said, well, you could always go to Catholic school. And I said, fine. And then she was like, shit, now I have to pay for it. Right. So it was my choice to go to private school. If I really had my choice, if we had money, then I would have gone to a non-parochial private school. But I think the only one was Newark Academy, and it was just wicked expensive. So I chose to go to the local, and I picked which school I wanted to go to. I had like an array of affordable options, and I picked the school that I wanted to go to. And one of the reasons I picked this one is because it was in their creed that they couldn't discriminate against you because of religion. So, you had to take religion classes because it was part of the curriculum and you had to go to church, but you didn't have to participate. So I got to sit and not kneel and whatever.
That argument didn't work for me. I said, I'll sit here quietly. I'm not going to disrupt your little service, your little ritualistic craziness. I'm just going to sit here quietly. They really, really wanted me to stand when the priest put his hands up. And at one point after that whole conversation where both my parents were called into the office, all this stuff, I had a teacher tell me, Antigone, you have to sing. And I said, no. There was a treaty sign where I need to stand and sit. I was a little difficult to deal with.
This is one of the libertarian stories that I was describing when I feel like the idiot kid, right? The late bloomer. Because there I was. In the same, and I'm dressed up like an altar boy. And this wasn't for the priest. I was an altar boy. The priest wasn't
Doing some like role playing.
No. I was actually an altar boy. And I would ring the bell, when the priest held the things up. I wasn't just standing up. I was there with the bells. And I would ring them and I would go ching-a-ling-a-ling-ling to my friend who was next to me. We were into it. And it was the wake-up call for me was one time I was maybe like in fourth grade. We're getting ready to do one of the sacraments. So we're all sitting there in the pews of the church during CCD. And
you kids. Oh, you kids would put all your bubble gum underneath our desks and we would find it all Monday morning. I did not like you kids.
Well, this is this part of this whole thing is forgiveness. So we were sitting there and we were talking. They never explained the whole Jesus thing like chronologically to us before.
Because they can't.
Well, that's what I learned and learned it in retrospect. Because at the time, I just felt bad at the time. Like I did something wrong.
Did something wrong by what? Like not
by
understanding?
Being born.
By being inquisitive.
Right.
So this was the conversation. We're talking about we understand BC AD, right? And we think that BC is before Christ and AD is, they told us it meant after death.
Anno Domini.
Domine, like the year or the time of the Lord. Yeah. So somebody said after death, right? So I'm like, well, how the heck is it 1 BC and then 1 AD? So was the life of this guy like, just like, was he a baby? And did they do this to a baby? Did time stop? Is there some other, like, so we
did you actually ask them, did they crucify this baby?
No. We were just talking about it with a couple of friends. And we're, inquisitive, young, curious kids trying to speculate about what this all means.
So
trying
you
to
didn't
make
know about 6-hour acid trips at that time.
No. So the nun, Sister Catherine, comes up and she says, that is not an appropriate conversation to be having. She walked away. And I was like, well, oh, thank God we're getting ready to do the sacrament of confession because I'm a sinner.
Oh, my God.
No, I didn't.
Your God?
But that was an exaggeration, but I did feel bad. I did feel like I had done something wrong.
How old were you?
8.
Oh, yeah. See, when I was a little bit older, when I went to Catholic school, I knew the answers to these questions, but I was a little shit, so I asked them anyway.
And I didn't,
I was just being difficult. But no, I wasn't 8. I was like 13. That there's a difference.
Right.
Generally.
Well, even at 8, they said.
That's when you can sin.
God took. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Isn't it 7 or 8 years old? You can start sinning. That's when you're responsible for your own sins.
7 or 8. That's when you get communion.
And I was counting swears. I was counting swears for confession at one point.
I didn't swear because I barely knew English, so...
You didn't swear in Portuguese?
No. because if someone would cut off my mom, like while she was driving, she would say banana, which is banana. She would call the guy a banana. They didn't really swear. So, but as far as that question, because I also had that question, and now it's BCE and CE, before Common Era and Common Era.
That's what we used in college, yeah.
That's the PC way of saying things, because I also had that question. So he was 33, right? So what does that mean?
Yeah.
That 33 years just don't exist. And then I also asked about burning bushes and stuff. I asked, in high school, I asked, so what kind of mushrooms did they have growing in these areas? And the class in which I asked this question was the one semester of religion in which I got an A. Every other semester of religion, I got a B+. It's not like, you know, I can memorize your shit. I can regurgitate all this, right? And get an A in everything, but always a B+ in religion. Interesting. Interesting how that worked out.
Yeah, I almost failed high school because I almost failed my religion class my senior year.
Gosh, well, I just wish I'd had that wisdom for that interaction with the nun, because it would have been like, well, give us something, Sister Catherine, you know, and where would she go? Like, you know, religion is another way to learn for a child who conforms. And again, that quiet resignation that I feel like characterizes so much of my childhood. It's another place to learn all the things that are wrong with you and all the limitations, you know, of your being, and why you need some kind of benevolent but firm authority. So we all, you know, this pile on of church, school, the state that, you know, if they're open, they're making laws, you know. If the lights are on and people are inside, that's their job. That's what they're doing. And, you know, I think outside of school and church, we have all these other ways, too, that we kind of started to get into with you were talking about the impossibility of being able to do today what your father did, you know, with an apprenticeship.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think of, you know, a lot of the situations that kids are in when they're not in good situations with their family and how inescapable it is. Like, it's very hard to get emancipated. I think I read today, and I tried to do some more research on statistics, but it was very hard to find that, like, only 1% of emancipation petitions are granted. And there, you know, there's a number of things that a number of requirements that need to be fulfilled for the courts to even consider it. Like, you need to be financially stable. You need to have a place to live. Like, I guess that kind of makes sense. You can get emancipated without a court in most states just by getting married or joining the military. I also thought it was interesting. I was kind of under the assumption that the legal age of majority was pretty much 18 everywhere in the United States, but it's not. In some places, it's 20. In some places, it's 18. But if you're still in high school, you're not of the age of majority until you graduate high school. In Hawaii, it can be extended up to 23 if you're in college.
What does that mean?
That means if you go to a state-accredited university that you're still under your parents' dominion up until the age of 23.
And probably the way that they presented that was about health insurance. Because I know that I was under my parents' health insurance until I was 23, as long as I was in college. So health insurance, of course, is something that's made super expensive because of the government, but then you need the government in order to mandate it, to, you know,
but you don't have to have health insurance. I didn't have health insurance when I was a kid.
Well, I sure appreciated having it, but I didn't have anything to do with it. That was a California law. And then that aspect of it, I don't know about majority age, but now health insurance via your parents has been upped to 26 in some places. And people will think of this as a positive thing. You get health insurance. But a 26-year-old?
Yeah.
I don't think anyone would argue that a 26-year-old is not an adult.
Well, I think a lot of people, I think that that's, there's an author named Robert Epstein. I think he's a psychologist, and he wrote a book called The Case Against Adolescence. And this conversation reminds me of one of the topics in that book, which is the infantilization of our population, which has happened through so many ways, where, you know, 100 years ago, before the, like, or around the invention of adolescence, you would have been an adult, and had adult expectations and responsibilities 10 years before that, at least. But he actually says 26 is this new magic age of adulthood, if you look at all of these factors in society. But there is no this goes back to, like, you know, parents being attentive to the needs and developments and milestones of a child far earlier than that, recognizing when they are capable of more freedom and autonomy and independence and privacy. So there's nothing magical even about 18, right? It's just a line that somebody drew that's just completely arbitrary. In fact, from studies that I've seen, it says that the intelligent peaks, as far as when you can learn the most, when your mind is most flexible and able to integrate new information, you're 14 or 15. But you're trapped in this place filling out worksheets at that time.
Dittos.
Yeah.
They used to call them dittos. Do you know where the 18-year-old thing came from?
I have no idea. But, like, the idea that competency happens on that birthday is just completely arbitrary. But, I mean, it's a big deal legally, right? Because also in this book, Epstein talks about restrictions. And this goes back to the state and the lawmakers a little bit. That today, adolescents, these were his numbers, but I think it's interesting, have 10 times the restrictions placed on them legally as adults. And Epstein's claim in an article, I think it was called Trashing Teens. He wrote an article called Trashing Teens where he said adolescents have twice the amount of restrictions as inmates.
Oh, yeah. Legally. You know what I was talking about before, about corporal punishment being legal in like 19 schools, completely illegal in the penal systems. And I'm not saying that would be right if that was okay, but I find it interesting that you cannot abuse prisoners and inmates, but you can abuse children.
Well, I mean, you definitely can. And I've had friends that went to Valley Street Jail in Manchester. They have things thrown at them and they're called things, etc. But
yeah, but that's all very unofficial, you know.
But if it's corporal punishment, it's physical violence and they have things thrown at them. And
yeah, but
I know,
like,
for a fact,
it's kind of like ritualized violence, corporal punishment, not just like bullying. And
throwing, no, I mean, not, if you hit someone or if you throw something at someone, I think that's pretty much the same thing.
Legally, it's not the same thing, is
what
I'm saying.
We all know that inmates, prisoners, this is the forgotten population. No one cares about how prisoners are treated. You may be there for smoking a joint.
Right.
Okay, you're not hurting anyone, etc. No one gives a fuck about prisoners. And so we're now talking about children's rights, and it's the same thing.
It's totally the same thing. Except in a legal sense, prisoners have more rights than children.
Well, at least they can sue.
Yeah.
They can sue afterwards. Children can't do that.
But back to apprenticeships, my point about that is that, you know, not just apprenticeships, but also child labor laws. If these things weren't in place, we probably wouldn't have a need for, and I know this is probably going to be a pretty controversial statement, but we probably wouldn't have a need for things like Child Protective Services or DCFS or anything like that if children who wanted to be were allowed to be autonomous. And the system is totally set up to prevent that from happening.
Well, I would agree with you. I would agree with you as far as kids like 10 years or older. Okay, that's the easy part.
The kids,
right?
Who are old enough to speak up, who are usually the ones, or the kids who are old enough to push back.
Right. So say you have a 10-year-old who is...
Well, no, say you have a 2-year-old.
Right.
A 2-year-old that's being abused. That's not going to help.
No, it's not going to help, but it would allow them to attain autonomy quicker than in the current system that we have now. Say you're 10 years old. And you're in a bad situation, you're being abused or you're being neglected, you know, your alternatives are pretty much put up with it or go into the system, become a ward of the state, end up as a foster child. Now, if you're 2 or maybe younger, you know, you're probably going to have a better chance of actually getting adopted. But a 10-year-old does not get adopted very, very rarely. So, I mean, if we had the option that, you know, if the child at 10 had the option to say, go become an apprentice, right, and go get like room and board and maybe a wage and someone to care for them as another option. But somewhere in the early 1900s, the National Apprenticeship Act was enacted, and that meant that the government was going to regulate apprenticeships. And now apprenticeships are pretty much in the hands of unions.
Do they still exist, apprenticeships?
I was an apprentice.
As an adult.
As an adult, yeah. No, there are no childhood apprenticeships anymore.
Because the way I learned about it in school was that instead of going to a higher education...
What we have now is VOTEC. So now public education has control of what we might think of as childhood apprenticeship.
Yeah.
So you know, you go into a vocational academy that's controlled by the state instead of, you know, being like my dad did and like, I want to go study with a shoemaker and that's what I'm going to do.
But this vocational academy is not for children. This vocational academy is for people who are done with high school that don't want to go to college.
No, you can do that. You can do like a VOTEC in place of high school.
Yeah. Now, who swings from the teat of these laws? If you think about that, corporations are always happy to have taxpayers fund the training of their labor force, which is what the vocational program essentially is, right? So instead of doing apprenticeships where they have to pay the person very little, supervise them, they can have the training of that person in some kind of trade subsidized by the taxpayers in the town of that vocational school. Because it's not private, it's not separate. In my high school, it was the same building. The teachers' unions. And this is the whole thing. When it comes to the relationship and the dialogue from bureaucrats or politicians or parents or teachers to children, if it wasn't for hypocrisy, all they could do was sit there in silence. There'd be nothing to say. There'd be nothing to do. So we look at some of these things like child labor laws, right? Why are these enacted? What's the justification? Because everything has a justification.
I think it's really interesting. Very soon after, maybe like 10 years after the first trade union organization was formed, that was in 1827.
Yep.
One of their major platforms was funding public education or supporting free public education for anyone. And then like 10 years later was, you know, part of man's reforms was organizing teachers into a union. And then shortly after that in Massachusetts, maybe like 20 years later, was the first compulsory education. So it seems to me that it was, you know, these unions lobbying for, you know, kids to be taken out of the workforce so they wouldn't take their jobs.
Okay, sure. I think that that's certainly part of it. But when we say we don't know the justifications for it, we can basically just do government rationalization Mad Libs here, where it's like, this is necessary and good, blank, 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 children, blank, 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 common good.
Yeah, but I guess the justification is it's for the children.
Right. So where do these, and this goes back to the hypocrisy, where do these, the intentions, right? This is mostly in the progressive era, which is, you know, around the time that there is this heavy industrialization in this country and kids are in factories, right? And this is presented in college by, you know, your lefty college professor as the runaway free market. Right? Look what happened to these kids in a runaway free market. Well, I mean, the truth is that all throughout history, at least back to the Middle Ages, when probably a lot of these apprenticeships exist in other kinds of trades, kids worked. Like people that age who were in those factories, they worked. And all the way back to ancient China, kids were pretty much treated like shit. So it stands to reason that if society industrializes and they go into factories, kids will work and they'll be treated like shit because that's the way it always was. But also, it wasn't greedy industrialists, not that they deserve any kind of a pass, people like, you know, Rockefeller or Carnegie or any of them, who are forcing kids into factories. Who made the kids work? Their parents.
Yeah.
Right? And then it's always presented as like...
Does this go back to the Macaulay Culkin thing where like the parents take all the money? Because I would have totally worked as early as I possibly could have in order to have my money to spend the way that I wanted to spend.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, parents do have the right to your income until you're emancipated, whether by legal recourse or by reaching the age of majority.
So my parents were just nice.
That sounds like a law that was passed by adults.
Oh, yeah. You think? I mean, that's one of the reasons people do get emancipated.
Yeah. Well,
if Google was as popular back then as it was now, I may have done it. But it was just way too hard to find all the legal information at the time.
I didn't really have to do anything to get emancipated. I got kicked out of my house. Somebody tipped off my mother that, you know, she might get sued for neglect or something or, you know, get brought up on charges. So she sent police to my job to try to bring me home. And I only found out about this when my general manager called me into his office and said, police just showed up here looking for you. I sent them away. And I was like, you know, he was just the coolest ever at that moment. But I realized I was in kind of a situation. So I went to my local police station and I said, this is the situation. You know, I want to be emancipated. And they were like, do you have a place to live? Yes. Here, fill out this paperwork. Like, I didn't even need to go before a judge. And maybe that was just because I was so close to the legal age of majority that they were like, "This, we don't even want to deal with this. This is just ridiculous." But I mean, that was just like, that was a fluke. I don't know what happened. In most cases, it is just very, very difficult for a child to get emancipated. And I mean, one of the reasons children try to get emancipated is because of cases of abuse. But generally, first of all, in most states, you have to be at least 16. I think there's one state where you can be 14 and apply for emancipation, but I don't know how often it's granted.
In California, you can apply for it, but right. It will go in front of a judge, and you know how that's going to
Yeah, and up. Your parents can contest it and whatever. But in most cases where a child tries to get emancipated or young adult tries to get emancipated because of cases of abuse, they will either, you know, try to place you with another family member or in foster care before even thinking about granting an emancipation.
But you need it to be emancipated to be in charge of your own income.
Right.
Right. So I don't know what individual motivations might have been. I think there could be a number of reasons. First of all, a factory then is what public school is today. It's childcare, you know, for the one thing, because the parents have to work. And as a society industrializes and there's all these new opportunities to make money, why not? You know, and I'm sure many, many kids preferred it. If they were given the choice, maybe they preferred it to school.
Or the hard labor they were doing on a farm or whatever their other options were.
Oh, my goodness.
Like, not starving. Like, maybe their only, you know, other option was starving. So, you know, then the unions come along and they, you know, try to force free public education. I'm not saying unions were the only factor. But what they're basically doing is saying, like, we don't want these kids to take our jobs.
Well, okay, so here we have this, like, progressives love to talk about how children were treated as workers right before the Progressive Era, but they don't want to talk about how children were treated 100 years before that, which was far worse, on the farm when they were totally, you know, when it was an agrarian society and those opportunities didn't exist. Now, obviously, listen, factory conditions were very bad, and it was like...
I'm not saying it was a great thing, but I think in a lot of cases, it was people's best option.
And who are you as the government to say, hey, no, you shouldn't work. You should just watch your little siblings die instead of going to work in order to feed them instead of school. But school didn't always exist. And what I looked into when I was looking into the whole universal healthcare thing was the parallels between that and schooling back in the day. And the language is the same, saying that only 90% of kids got educated. Now, what were those other 10% of kids doing? Were they doing unschooling with their parents? Were they working on the farm and
starting businesses
and enjoying it? Were they selling lemonade on the side of the street? I mean, we don't know what that 10% was doing.
I would want to know what got educated means.
Well,
because
sure.
I know what it means today as far as the public is concerned.
And it's indoctrination. And I would imagine, actually, it was funny. I was in a situation recently where a friend of mine asked this kid, this 17-year-old boy, man, whatever, and his mother was right there. He said, "Were you homeschooled? I can tell because you look me in the eye." That kid was homeschooled, and I could deal with him just fine. I later found out he was very, very Christian. His whole family was very, very Christian. So there's that whole aspect of the homeschooling community. But then in this same experience, I dealt with public school kids and they raised their hands for every little thing. And I found it very difficult to deal with them. But I found it very interesting that my friend, who's also a libertarian, who's been, you know, in most of the continents and has lived in many different countries, he said, "Are you homeschooled?" And when he said yes, this first thing was, "I could tell because he looked me in the eye." That was very, very interesting to me. And I'm probably going to start paying attention to that, actually. Where it's that whole, like, bowing down to adults, you don't look them in the eye. It was really easy to deal with this kid and just speaking with him on an equal basis.
And on the whole exploitation of children thing, though, people who bring up this child labor stuff, like, if they're supporting the public schools, you know, on the left, right? So I support public schools and I support all kinds of government spending. But I'm really, oh, geez, I just couldn't imagine a world where children are exploited. But, you know, public school used to last for 8 years. Now it lasts for 12. In some places, they're talking about making it 14.
It's, oh, with preschool and kindergarten.
Yeah,
right?
It's 15,000.
That's crazy.
It's 15,000 hours of a person's life. Who's the beneficiary of that? Of trapping children in a building, right? That makes jobs for unions. Stefan Molyneux made this video a couple years ago called "The Money Being Sold Abroad Is You," right? Where he shows just like a cattle farmer will leverage the future productivity of his livestock to borrow money from the bank today. What do you think the collateral is for the money that the government borrows from China? It's the productivity of the future tax base. So those arguments, I think, ring incredibly hollow as far as like, well, geez, I really care about child exploitation. Well, look at what you support. And I think a lot of people could never see that.
And now I'm going to really call bullshit on anybody who, you know, says anything about for the children, because if they were, you know, for the children, then they would be trying to get these child abuse laws repealed.
Yep.
Or at least be, Jesus Christ, speaking out against them.
It could be.
Nobody does that.
But, yeah. Celestina, you're talking about a system that is so old. Now, any abuse that, like, we mentioned earlier how parents will say, oh, you don't have it as bad as I did, right? So I was told growing up that if you did not finish your plate of food, you would get beaten because you did not appreciate that food, because the generation before the generation that prepared it, so what, that's three generations away from me, they didn't have any food. So if you don't finish every bite on your plate, you get beaten up. This makes absolutely no sense.
How interesting is this, right?
Because that my whole family's fat? Wait, go ahead.
There's a real... One thing that I notice about the adult world, and I'll bring this back to that, is like, you should have appreciation for this, right? So we're going to beat appreciation into you. In the adult world, there's a real lack of gratitude, or certainly not as much gratitude as there should be. In fact, there's this whole meme on the internet called First World Problems, where there's this woman...
I love that meme. We've talked about it before on this show.
There's this woman who looks all distraught, right? Like she's just at the end of her rope. And, you know, the caption will be something like, I left the cookies in the oven too long, right? Right. So there's a real, like, people...
Well, we now have the picture for this episode. We'll have one of those. I listened to SLA too long. Now I'm too in tune to the truth, or something like that.
So the lack of gratitude really seems to be, you know, one of my theories is that it's the result of a much larger problem where... One of the most common things that we hear growing up is do what I say for your own good. Suffer now. Be happy now so you can be happy later. So we go to school and we do all this mundane bullshit. And we say, oh, I got to do this so I can go to college. And then we get to college and we pull all-nighters and we write these long papers about things we may or may not be interested in. We say, oh, I got to do this so I can get a good job. Then we get a job and we say, oh, I can't wait for the weekend. Oh, I can't wait to get promoted. Oh, I can't wait till I retire. And then finally, I think when people retire, it's like, oh, I'm not waiting for anything else. Now I can be happy. So people never are happy now because they always think that satisfaction and happiness, self-actualization is something that's deferred because during the most formative years of your life, the decree was be miserable now so you can be happy later. And because of that, a lot of people wind up never being happy at all.
That's also the influence of religion too, because isn't that what most religions teach us?
It's all together. Like there is this line in Trainspotting, which was up in one of my companies, which was so hilarious that it was up. Just like, you know, you get good grades, you go to college, you knock someone up, so you marry them, they nag you, your kids are brats, you watch TV sucks, you retire, oh, your retirement's gone, blah, blah, blah. All of this stuff that you just inherit via this society. And religion's there, and the state is there, and my big issue, I think Protestants have less of it than Catholics do, But Catholics, which is my experience, which I know is Celestina's experience. I don't know if you went to Catholic or some other Christian school, Brett, but when you put value into suffering and sacrifice, particularly sacrifice, if you sacrifice, you will get something in the end, in the end, in the end, in the end,
mm-hmm.
right? When they're like, you know, virgins and harps and stuff, really? And then the Christians in America like to say that Muslims are so screwed up because of their, how many? 72 virgins? 72 virgins. But, you know, all this crap, it's all the same thing. You just suffer and you sacrifice. And basically, the more miserable you are, the better the payoff will be in an afterlife, in a retirement, in a this, in a that. And you have people that do not live in the now, that everything is so, so difficult.
There were so many times I heard when I was, you know, working in the tile industry, people saying, oh, I can't wait to retire. I can't, like 30-year-old guys going, oh, I can't wait to retire. Really? You're 30 years old and you can't wait to be like 70 and die in 5 years because you've got like silicosis or whatever, like, you know, has happened to you while you've been doing this job that you hate. Like, I did tile because I love doing tile. I enjoyed being, you know, in my job. If you don't enjoy being in your job, go buy a bakery. You know, go do something else. Like, how are you, you know, sitting here slaving away and waiting for death?
I think they get used to it via school.
I think that people, they're conditioned to live, to use a mystical term, purgatory. They're conditioned to live in that purgatory of never really being happy, but never really being unhappy enough to do something about it. Because it's, like I said, it's that quiet resignation of a child extended throughout a person's entire life. And yeah, you know, the mystical stuff, super sweet behavior management tools for the rulers, like to defer reward and punishment.
Yep.
And also, like, because I'm, you know, really, you know, it comes down to the end of the day, me as your authority, as your ruler, I'm kind of impotent, you know, really don't have much to do. I can't really reason with you, and my force that I use is totally illegitimate. But what does happen is that after you die, you know, up or down, and it's eternal. It's forever. So this is just
what,
like,
you do now doesn't matter.
Oh, well, no.
As long as you suffer a whole lot, you're okay.
Right. As long as you abide by these rules and you know you suffer at least enough, then you'll have this eternity in paradise with virgins and harps.
I want to clear one thing up because I know that I went to Catholic school and Celestina went to Catholic school for at least a certain amount of time. I don't know about Brett, but there are a lot of Christians that'll say, oh, wait, no, that's a Catholic thing. And I think that the Catholics are really good at bringing up, at elevating sacrifice and suffering to this whole new religious level of good. But I think it's a Christian thing altogether. So I don't want to say that it's only a Catholic thing.
But
religion and statism are very, very similar.
But it's also been codified in philosophy. I think I said at the very beginning of this show, we live basically, what is the prevailing philosophy in our society today is German idealism. Immanuel Kant, right? Which, spoiler alert, was...
Kant, always get what you want.
You say Kant a lot. Well, in your show, you say it a lot.
Kant. That's how it's pronounced, really. But you know, spoiler alert, this is the philosophy that made the Third Reich possible. Just if you... Maybe some clues about where we might be going in this country. But... One of Kant's things.
You're really good at making me feel really good about society. I'm not depressed right now at all. Just saying.
Well, one of Kant's missions was there's this whole phenomenal world beyond the understanding of human beings. One of his goals was to keep religion going in what was all around Central Europe, the Age of Enlightenment, which there's this vacuum where it wasn't happening. So out of the place where the Holy Roman Empire existed and there was no Enlightenment, instead you get... a century later, communist Russia and fascist Germany. So one of Kant's things that codifies some of these religious doctrines that we're talking about is called the ethics of duty, where sacrifice is noble. Now, geez, how does that play out? How did it play out in our society, right? That self-sacrifice became heroic.
Gee, I wonder where we see that.
Yeah.
I couldn't imagine a place in today's society where we see that. That's just so crazy, Brett. You're like a tinfoil hat guy. That's not the army or anything. When you go into high schools and talk to these kids that have no autonomy, that have been treated like idiots for the last, you know, dozen years, and then they get told, hey, your parents did not save up enough for college, and college is really your only option, we're going to take you and put you in the military.
But beyond, but how about relationships? I mean, I was in relationships in the past where I was sacrificing. And, you know, I think a lot of these unhealthy marriages that you're talking about, people feel like they're sacrificing, right? They're giving something up. And where does that go? Resentment, right? But people...
Well, I don't think you get so married as you get divorced. Just saying. That's pretty much what you're doing, because you're between 25 and 30, and that's what you're supposed to do. So I know that I was supposed to go to college. I was 11 years old when I found out that a cousin of mine dropped out of high school. And I was just like, oh, he's one of those. He's one of those numbers that I'd heard of, because in my experience, I was basically told, if you don't go to college, you're a loser. And then at this point, I found out my cousin didn't finish high school. So like, ooh, then he's a bad guy, right? Like, this was my limited experience. So like, he's like the loser of the losers, right? Because I just did not. I mean, of course, he kind of actually was, because he just impregnated all the welfare of all the town. And it was one of those stories. I don't know him too well, but my experience was, if you don't go to college, you make French fries at McDonald's for the rest of your life, which, of course, is not the case at all, because I had friends who instead created computer applications and created all this stuff and were making $80,000 a year when the rest of us were going to college, going into debt. So I'm not saying that was correct, but that was the mindset. If you don't go to college, you are a loser.
Yeah, I remember having a conversation with my niece once a few years ago where she asked me why I dropped out of college, and I tried to explain it to her. God, I could just feel the disappointment. My niece was so disappointed in me because it was pretty devastating. I felt really bad about it. You know, like, I knew I was right, but I felt so bad that she's like so brainwashed to have that mindset that, you know, maybe I was less than what I was because I dropped out of college.
Well, I don't know what her experience was, but for me at 11, like, that's all the information that I had. I mean, my parents were telling me that I was going to college from the time I was 5 years old.
Yeah.
And neener, I went to film school, which is nothing.
I went to art school.
Yeah, exactly, right? That's hilarious. I have a film degree.
Yeah, it didn't matter what you do. It's just important that you go to college. So we actually steered away quite a bit from our original proposed topic.
Because we never do that.
You know, I don't think we've ever done it as completely as we've done here today. But I think we've really had a wonderful conversation. So I'm not disappointed about it at all.
I think we covered a lot of good ground.
Yeah, absolutely. The one thing we have left to talk about is what are the solutions to what we just talked about, to the original proposed topic, which is how the government does not let children attain autonomy. And, you know, we're not going to get rid of CPS. We're not going to repeal child labor laws. We're not going to fix the regulation of apprenticeship programs. So I think the only thing you can do is just not be a shit to your child. That is like the only thing, unfortunately. But I mean, it's a huge thing. But and you know, I know probably most of our listeners are totally already on board with that idea. But more than that, I think, you know, when you see someone not being right to children, speak up, embarrass them, whatever. You know, this is just a really constant problem. And it's the root of everything that's probably wrong with everything in the world today.
I totally agree with that. With intervening, you know, using those kinds of opportunities to spread this message. Because as big and as powerful and as widespread as people calling themselves government are, it seems like they're always looking for somebody else, or those, you know, the most powerful are always looking for somebody else to do their dirty work, right? Employers become tax collectors. People, even your own family members, become in charge of shaming you for being outside of the mainstream. Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education, never calls me, you know, about my ideas that I express on School Sucks podcast. But I'll get angry emails from public school teachers, and I'll be told by people in my own family, you know, how utopian this is and foolish. And, you know, so I think that, yeah, you're right. And when it comes to parents, it seems like they often act maybe even reluctantly or, you know, naively as enforcers, perpetuators of all these things that we're talking about. You get in trouble at school. What did you do wrong? You're getting a C. Why are you not working hard enough? You know, instead of saying, like, my brother has a stepson who's, he was 12 at the time, and, you know, he wasn't getting a good grade. And these people in the family were, you know, at a dinner were like lecturing him about the importance of school. And I said, why don't you go meet with the teacher and ask her? Here's a bright young boy who's interested in this subject generally. Why don't you go ask her what she's doing wrong? You know, why don't you stand up instead of just being an apologist for this sick system, you know, this just, it's thoughtless and abusive. Why don't you stand up and advocate for this young person who's closest to you, who has no voice in that system for themselves? And, you know, I think a lot of parents try.
A lot of parents were in the same system.
Exactly. So they're complying and conforming to it as well. And sure, a lot of people who would listen to this podcast already understand this, but I think too often, and I even do it myself, they don't speak up as much as they should when, you know, an opportunity presents itself, as you were saying, Celestina, to do so. If we did more of that, you know, in an authentic way, not in a judging way, not in a shaming way, it's tricky. It takes practice. It takes a lot of thought. But I think it's something that's very important that people need to stop doing, you know?
No, I did say shaming. Yeah, go ahead and shame someone if they're being a real dick to their kids in public.
But you know, what is, I would think that that's just something that would be stored up by them and taken out on their kid later.
Not necessarily. I mean,
I really, from my experience, and I've really spent a lot of time in the lab on this one.
Yeah.
You can't shame someone into agreeing with you, you know?
No.
Wait, where's this lab?
No, but I think you can make someone think about, you know, maybe they just never thought about before how it was wrong, and maybe they'll be embarrassed by their behavior.
I think it's difficult to make a general rule, and sometimes that might work. And, you know, I would think, obviously, like I said, sometimes it wouldn't. You know, when I envision, I've never really come face to face with a situation where intervention was absolutely necessary because a human being was being abused right in front of my eyes.
I have. At work, at a job I had, I threw someone out of my store. I yelled at her and embarrassed her and threw her out of my store. I don't know what the result of that was, you know, and maybe, I don't know, maybe that wasn't the right way to go about it. I mean, I think things need to be taken on a case-by-case basis.
And I would just be afraid, you know, I mean, of how that would just be immediately, that shame that the person felt would just be immediately transferred, which is so easy for a parent to do.
Yeah, but if someone's already that much of a jerk, that's what they're doing already, isn't there?
Yeah, I would say that it's probably inevitable, and they're going to find an excuse to do it sooner or later. But, you know, when I envision these situations, and maybe it's something that I'll encounter at some point in life, you going up to the person and saying, do you need help? Right? Do you need help? And then, you know, you could see where that goes, and maybe you could make some kind of just an appeal to practicality. If they're willing to talk to you, what you're doing doesn't work, you know, because to pass a moral judgment on somebody right away is just going to make them, you know, push you away. But what you're doing is making your life and that child's life more difficult. I think that would be worth a try. But that's a person who needs help. That's an adult who is transferring whatever their trauma is onto the next generation. That's the inheritance.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's not an excuse.
No, of course it's not an excuse, but they still need help, and possibly by helping them, you help that child. So, I mean, you're trying to create win-win situations wherever possible. And, I just know from my own experience, from having so much experience on trying to shame people, it's ultimately lose-lose, because then when they feel that shame, they just turn around and attack you.
I mean, but maybe they just thought that nobody ever noticed this thing that I'm doing wrong, and somebody just noticed and they called me out on it.
Sure.
You know, and they called me out on it publicly. So maybe there's something wrong with it, or maybe it's something that, you know, even if I don't think it's wrong, that I should stop doing because I'm embarrassed. I don't know. Maybe I'm just, maybe you're just nicer than me. Maybe I just want to be angry at that person.
Oh, no. And no, trust me. I know that feeling.
You know, maybe you're right.
Like, I caught myself in the car today rehearsing an argument that I expect to have in the future. And in the argument, in the rehearsal, I'm kicking ass. You know, and I stopped and I said, what is this about? Is this about me thoughtfully planning an information exchange, or is this about, you know, my ego? But I caught myself driving and rehearsing an argument. So I certainly understand that. And, it's still so easy to get so frustrated. Yesterday on Facebook and in the real world, it was a very frustrating day for people, you know, who think like we do.
Yeah.
And
I ignored my Facebook all day.
And that's, I looked on Facebook. I went on Imgur. I went on Twitter. I had a couple of semi, you know, jabbity tweets at the whole process. And I even turned on the television, which I almost never do. It was on for about 5 minutes because I was like, oh, my goodness. But, I think that we've, at the very least, we've all found good outlets for this, right?
Podcasts. You mean like what we're doing right
yeah,
now?
Yeah, this is great. Look at us. We're all smiling, right? And we're talking about things that make us angry.
Despite it all.
Yeah. So, you know, it's good to have a way to turn that valve. Because I think for a lot of people, they get into these ideas are so appealing and they're so obvious and they're so undeniable if you're willing to understand them. I've found that, it can build up. It can get frustrating. And this has been a good way for me to turn that valve once in a while and let it out.
Yeah.
So.
Also, when this situation happened, I was like 20.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I couldn't imagine what I would do. I probably, there were periods in my life where I thought it was okay. So, I mean, yeah.
But I think a little part of me still thinks it's okay because I did just advocate embarrassing someone who is doing something awful.
No, I mean, I would have thought that it would be okay for a parent to spank somebody.
Oh, okay.
You know, at one point in my life. So, yeah, a lot changes in 15 years for sure, for me anyway.
I'm not sure how I would handle that situation today. I had a situation, it wasn't a situation because I was on my way into work and I was right in front of the building. And I, you know, this job I like. And, you know, I was on my way into the building and I heard someone talking to their child and I wasn't in a situation where I could have intervened. And I'm not really sure what I could have done, but the conversation in my head, I definitely had a conversation in my head about what I would have done. And it was like, I don't know, a grandfather or an uncle or something talking to this kid. And he was like talking to him very rationally. Like he was saying, you know, like what you did upset your parents and like really just kind of, you know, explaining things to him. And when you get home, your father's going to slap your ass. I wanted to say you were doing so well.
Yeah.
Shit face. You know? And that's the 20-year-old in me that added that bit on the end. You know, but I was so frustrated because I was right in front of my job where I couldn't have said that.
I always
and maybe I'm a little embarrassed that I didn't anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've had those moments as well, like in grocery stores or my next door neighbors, how they yell at their kids and how they treat their kids. Like, you don't actually want to be a parent, do you? Because you treat these children like dogs, or worse than that. You would treat a dog better than that.
Mm. Yeah, there's laws about hitting your dog,
right? And there are no laws about hitting your kids. But anyway, I don't know where we can really go with
now I'm
this.
Back to being depressed again.
In my fantasy arguments, instead of shit face.
That was like a nice word I came up with for what I was thinking.
I say pecker neck.
Thanks for putting a smile on my face again. So, yeah, I mean, like I said, just, you know, be cool to your kids and just remember what it was like when you were a kid. I think, you know, I think people kind of forget about how absolutely miserable childhood is. So my advice would be just to, you know, and I'm not a parent, so I can't really say these things.
Oh, stop it. I hate that.
I know. I'm laughing about that because we were talking about that two or three episodes ago.
Be nice to your teenagers.
And you, as you've said before, you know, not having this whole understanding clouded with the experience of being a parent, and you can go directly back to when it is a kid, you are in no less a position to speak up. And they say, oh, you don't understand, you're not a parent. The last show that I did on School Sucks Podcast was part of our Logic series, and the entire show was about Bill Maher, the very, very progressive liberal political commentator. And you know, the subtext of it is that he's kind of a hack and not very smart. But in one moment of brilliance on his show, and he was probably, the way he was using this statement was probably in a way that I don't agree with, but he said, I don't have kids, right? But I also don't have fish. And I know you're not supposed to fill their tank with Mountain Dew. And I thought that was one of the most brilliant lines his liberal writers ever wrote for him. But yeah,
Did he stop calling himself libertarian?
Yes.
Because he used to. Oh, yeah. Excellent. Great. I'm glad.
Now he says, I'm sort of a kind of a libertarian.
Oh, God.
Which means I want to legalize
but
pot.
The children.
Yeah. Oh, was real into, yeah, he was real into like the Tiger Mom thing. I mean, yeah, but that's...
What do you mean he was into that?
He had her on the show. He was like, oh, I think this is great, and these little snot-nosed brats. But that's the kind of parenting that serves his political views. You know, that kind of treatment of children is what makes this political paradigm in which we live entirely possible. So
on that depressing note,
how about one more smile from everyone?
Yeah, one more smile. Give us something to smile about, Brett.
That sounded real
promising.
Give me a topic.
Fish.
Fish. One time I had got all these fish and I was a kid. And I said, I'm going to take the best care of these fish. But I knew they needed some kind of liquid in their tank. But all I had was Mountain Dew. Get it?
It's got electrolytes,
Do you
right?
remember that from the last story? How I brought that full circle?
Yeah, I think we all got that.
It's what fish crave.
Indeed.
All right, what's a funny story about fish?
They all love Mountain Dew. We can just stick with that.
I can come up with a new topic.
No.
Do one other one besides fish.
Go, Antigone.
Well, now I'm just thinking like seaweed or something. So
get away from the ocean.
Get away from the ocean.
Let's go to a new place.
Make a joke about... GMOs.
GMOs.
You and GMOs, I swear.
It's my thing now. I'm sorry. It's totally my thing now. How about hippies?
Oh, hippies.
Here we go. Hippies.
What do hippies do these days?
Vote.
What do they want?
Maggie Hassan.
Tell us a happy story, Brett.
I'll tell you my two favorite jokes by comedians. These are not my original jokes, but I'll retell them. All right. The first one is David Angelo. I hope to maybe have on my show someday. Boy, these Eskimos, and he's very, very dry. He's like Stephen Wright dry. These Eskimos, what a fascinating culture they have. So different from ours. Do you know they have 47 ways to say in sign language? I can't understand you with your mittens on. And my second one, little different speed, is Anthony Jeselnik. Do you know who he is? Anthony Jeselnik, this is his joke. He said, my girlfriend and I went to stay with her dad, and it was so uncomfortable because he's such a prude and he made us sleep in different rooms. And he said, I'm sorry, Anthony, I just don't trust you. And I said, sir, trust me, I'm fucking your daughter. One more. Anthony Jeselnik. I just read the biography of the guy who invented Super Mario Brothers. Do you know when he was a kid, people used to laugh at him when he would kill turtles with a hammer? Comedy.
All right.
Oh, dear Lord.
I got one more. I got one. How many surrealists does it take to screw in a light bulb?
How many, Celestina?
Fish.
There we go.
Bringing it back.
Good job. Full circle.
So thank you so much, Brett, for being here today.
My pleasure.
You got anything you want to plug?
Yeah, well, here's the list. SchoolSucksProject.com is my website. We're going to launch a new site, hopefully within the next couple of weeks. I have a Facebook page that I would like everyone to like. They can just put in School Sucks Podcast and they'll find us. We have a Twitter page called School Sucks Show. They should follow us. I hear it's good to have a lot of followers on Twitter. We also have a YouTube channel, School Sucks Podcast. You'll find it. There's lots of videos on there. And we have a live show every Thursday night at SchoolSucksProject.com/live. And you can call in, you can participate in our chat, and it's a really different experience than what a lot of the podcasts ultimately turn out to be. So that's it.
You got anything you want to plug, Antigone?
Do I now? If you're interested in following Sex, Lies, and Anarchy, we also have a Twitter page.
We do?
Yes, we do. You don't know about it because everything we put on Facebook also goes on Twitter. And we also have a Tumblr and iTunes if you want to subscribe to the show. So we're easily findable. SexLiesAnarchy.com if you want to go to our actual page. And Facebook is really where you're going to find all our little extras with Candy doing her little webcam stuff. And she recently put out her video parodying an Obama commercial. So
you should have really just left that to people's imaginations with Candy's webcam stuff. You've been listening to Sex,
Lies,
and Anarchy,
where liberty gets personal.